Here are some American voices speaking about freedom of religion.
Well, currently there's a lot of tension in America over religion. It's similar to when the Irish came here and they had tension with the Protestants, and now it's the Muslims having tension with the Christians. But I think these things will be overcome over time.
It's important for people to be able to have religious freedom because everybody has a different higher being. And I know who I believe in, and I think everybody should be able to believe in who they want to believe in.
Free thinking is important to me, and that the ability to worship or think in the ways that are best suited for your life and experience are important to me. The U.S. believes that it is special in its religious freedoms. Whether it actually is exercising a tolerance of diverse religions is something that it continues to try to work on.
You know, people should just be free to just, you know, think, you know, believe what they want.
Because I'm against religion, so I want to be free. In fact, there's a, have you heard of the Freedom From Religion Foundation? Yeah, I'm kind of like with them.
I value religious freedom. As a Buddhist, I believe everyone has the right to believe whatever they want to believe without any kind of reaction from the community or the government.
I don't want people making me practice their particular religion, and I would rather just be able to investigate any religion I'm curious about or have no religion at all if I want.
I don't really pay much attention to it. I just think that you should be able to believe in whatever you believe in.
I think that basically most people in this country don't value religious freedom because they take it for granted. They don't come from countries like in Eastern Europe where you've been forbade to practice religion. So I think looking at it from that perspective, I think it's hard for an American to appreciate religious freedom because we get it so easily.
I think it gives a person a chance to express himself in a free country.
And freedom of your thoughts and in spiritual matters, as all other matters, is a foundation for kind of a democratic society. I have to think that there is still some uniqueness to the American experience that clearly historically has valued freedom.
Welcome to Religion and the Constitution. This is a series of conversations about the law and what freedom of religion actually means in the United States. My name is Jerry Dunkley. Hello and welcome. In today's podcast, we're going to discuss some history, part of which deals with anti-Catholicism in the United States most strongly in the period after the Civil War. We're going to bring that issue up to the present day because the decisions made by politicians back then turn out to be relevant now. It has to do with something called the Blaine Amendments. It's a fascinating history, but that fact that the issues affecting citizens then are still echoing in the courts almost 150 years later is also remarkable. The latest evidence is the Supreme Court decision in the Trinity Lutheran case in the summer of 2017. That decision may be tangled up in the issue of tax dollars eventually going to support more non-public schools through voucher programs. It can get a bit complex. So to help us sort all of this out is our guest, Lyle Denniston. Lyle is a journalist. He covered the Supreme Court for decades. He reported for several newspapers, for National Public Radio, for the Supreme Court blog called the SCOTUS blog, which covers the court. And he is now with the National Constitution Center as its literacy advisor. He's won numerous awards for reporting and has also been inducted into the Society of Professional Journalists National Hall of Fame. And as an SPJ member, Lyle, let me say thank you for doing that and congratulations.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. I've had a long career and happily here and there it got recognized.
Well, I understand, then that's wonderful. Let's get right into it here. Let's do some of the history first. Talk about the attempt by Representative James Blaine to pass a federal constitutional amendment to ban any public spending on non-public schools back in 1889.
Well, the idea originated really, at least as a public matter, with a speech that President Ulysses S. Grant had made at a time when there was a very wide campaign of in public conversation about denying public money to parochial schools. And President Grant, in a speech to a veterans meeting, proposed a constitutional amendment that would, at the national constitutional level, prohibit any funds of the government from going to finance parochial education. There was a Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, James Blaine, that's spelled B-L-A-I-N-E, who took up Grant's proposal in 1875 and proposed this constitutional amendment. It got sufficient number of votes in the House of Representatives, but it failed narrowly in the United States Senate, so it never became a part of the Constitution.
It lost by only 4 votes, if I am reading it correctly.
That's what I think the historic record shows, that it just barely failed. And at the time, apparently, there was a significant fervor in public conversation about the breach of the traditional separation of church and government through the medium of spending public funds on parochial education. But at the same time, there was this kind of anti-immigrant movement in this country known as the Know Nothing Party that was very strongly anti-Catholic. So these two efforts, the anti-Catholic nativist approach, as well as the anti-funding approach, sort of mixed together in a pretty volatile political mix at the time. There is, however, Jerry, a really serious and deep debate among historians, historians of the law, historians of religion in American life, as to whether or not the state equivalents of the Blaine Amendment were motivated by anti-Catholic bias. There is one group of scholars that believes very strongly that the state Blaine Amendments were all tied up with the question of developing public schools as an independent source of education in America. Recalling that in the early years of the American history, many of the schools were sectarian. They were they taught morals and religion as well as the three R's.
And Lyle, it was not uncommon during the colonial period and after for public money to go for Protestant schools. Is that correct?
Well, that's true, because for many years in the early part of the American history, many of the states had provisions in their constitutions that established state churches. Like, for example, the Episcopal Church in Virginia was a state government-sanctioned church. So being a part of the state establishment, it obviously depended upon public funding. But there was a movement that began, I would say, maybe in the as early as the 1850s, that then spread more rapidly during the 1870s to disestablish state government from religion. And ultimately, all of the states that had a state-sponsored religion abandoned that. But it's a little confusing in American history how much intertie there is between that anti-church establishment movement and the public school movement. There is obviously, I think, considerable overlap, but there's always a question whether or not this was really all of it driven by anti-Catholic sentiment, because there was enormous popularity of the idea of developing public schools for universal public education. And so that was going on, particularly in states where there were not large Catholic populations in the 1870s. But I think the earliest state constitutional amendment forbidding public funding to parochial schools goes back as far as 1835 in Michigan. So there is a long history of the state Blaine amendments, and ultimately now 38 states still retain those amendments, and they are quite commonly flat bans on any transfer of public money from the state to a religious entity.
I want to talk more about the state Blaine amendments in just a moment, but let's go back to the Catholic situation a little bit. Apparently there was a nativist, as you use that term, fear, particularly of the Irish Catholics, and the Catholic Church has a long history of building schools along with its churches all over the world, and they were doing that extensively in the United States. And that led to these concerns about Catholic schools being funded by public money, correct?
Yes, and that's exactly true.
Okay. Now, Blaine eventually ran for the presidency in 1884, and he lost. And a lot of historians say that's because Catholics voted en masse against him. Is that your understanding of that?
Well, I think that's, I believe that's the interpretation of the record that I have seen and consider most persuasive. Though Blaine did make a specific attempt to appeal to Catholic voters, but you may remember in history there is this famous political phrase of, it was kind of dirty tricks of the kind that were practiced in those days, where Blaine's candidacy was opposed by people who used the phrase rum, Romanism, and rebellion. And because Blaine, as a presidential candidate, was trying to attract Catholic votes, even though he had in his background the history as a congressman of having sponsored this amendment, the proposed constitutional amendment in 1875. But when he ran for the presidency, he was accused of trying to appeal to, quote, Romanism, as unquote, as anti-Catholic sentiment was phrased at the time.
Now, let's talk about another aspect of this history, which is fascinating to me, and I did not know this until recently. As we're talking about this period, 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and new territories in the West were becoming states. And my understanding is that there was a requirement of the Congress that these new states, as they were created, establish a Blaine Amendment as a part of their own constitutions. Is that your understanding of that as well?
Well, I'm not familiar with that. Is it your understanding that that was a part of the Missouri Compromise?
I don't remember exactly from my reading, Lyle, where I got that. Yeah,
well, you know, the Missouri Compromise was the attempt to try to deal with the secessionist controversy. In trying to keep states in the Union, Congress mandated that some states be admitted as free states and that be offset by the admission of some states that could be slave states. And the free states were the ones mostly in the Western territories. But it could have been, and that's just not a part of the history that I'm familiar with, that they could have had these Blaine Amendment proposals. Now, in many of these territories, the question of public education was a very vital part of the foundation of state governments. So it is, I suppose it would not have been at all surprising if there were an attempt to insist upon adequate state funding of public schools. And that, of course, Jerry, is also reflected in the establishment of land-grant colleges. My own undergraduate university, the University of Nebraska, was one of these land-grant colleges that were founded in order to advance education at the secondary level in public institutions under what I think is called the Morrill, M-A-R-R-I-L-L, Act. So there was a strong impetus in the development of the territories to have universal public education, not only at the elementary and secondary level, but also at the college and university level. And I would be at all surprised to learn if a part of that was to insist upon public funding of those educational experiments.
I went to Michigan State, also a land-grant college, and actually has a building on campus called Morrill Hall, dedicated to the Land-Grant Act, the Morrill Land-Grant Act back in the 1850s. It's pretty remarkable, actually, the impact of that law over the last century and a half.
Well, by the same token, my undergraduate university, the University of Nebraska, also has a Morrill Hall. So for years, and perhaps appropriately, for years the college, the teachers' college, was located in Morrill Hall.
So anti-Catholic bigotry had a major impact back then, but these amendments, as we've discussed, are still in place. And the question is, what is their current power? And that brings us to this case out of Missouri. The Supreme Court decided in the summer of 2017, the Trinity Lutheran versus Pauley case. Missouri has a Blaine Amendment, which their government said prevented them from giving money, public money, to resurface a playground at the church. The Supreme Court disagreed with that analysis of the state of Missouri. Tell us about this case.
Well, this was a major test case. We have been seeing in recent years the rise of very aggressive, or at least very energetic, attempts to expand the constitutional concept of religious freedom. And we've seen it in a number of different venues and areas of public policy. Just 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we had the Supreme Court decision in what's called the Hobby Lobby case, which for the first time recognized that privately owned corporations that were owned by religiously devout people could not be compelled to obey a part of the Affordable Care Act that required that female employees be given free access to birth control methods and techniques. But there is a spreading movement in this country to expand the constitutional concept of religious freedom, particularly through the use of the Free Exercise Clause. So the Missouri case that was decided just last month was the latest iteration of this constitutional controversy, and it came out, I think, quite surprisingly, as a very strong decision against discrimination against religious institutions solely because they were religious in nature. The majority of the court went to considerable lengths to try to suggest that the opinion was very narrow, dealing only with a generally available public benefit that was neutral as to religion. At least two of the justices were not convinced that it was narrow. Justice Sotomayor wrote a dissent, joined by Justice Ginsburg, in which they saw this as the first time in American history that the Supreme Court had validated the direct transfer of public funds to a religious institution without any restriction on its ability to use the public fund to advance its religious mission. because this program, even though it was at its core only about recycling used tires in order to prepare and lay down a softer surface for school playgrounds, actually the program at the Trinity Lutheran Church in Columbia, Missouri, was a program in which the preschool itself was considered a part of the teaching mission. So it was attempting to advance the religion of its own families who brought their children to the preschools. But it was also a kind of a attempt to reach out to the community to bring in more neighborhood children, community children, in order to advance among them the religious mission. So the dissenters argued that this decision was a major frontal attack on the disestablishment concepts that are embodied in the 38 states Blaine Amendment still on the books. Now, we don't know how this decision will radiate outward from this used tire playground surface program. But a day after the court announced that decision, they returned to lower courts two issues to be reexamined in the wake of the Trinity Lutheran Church. One of those it has to do with a program of scholarship grants to students attending parochial schools. The other has to do with the lending of textbook and other educational materials that are provided by states to parochial schools. So in sending these two cases back for reconsideration in the wake of the Trinity Lutheran decision, the Supreme Court may have sent a signal that Trinity Lutheran will wind up meaning more, having a wider impact than this spare tire surfacing program.
Well, those people who support school vouchers for private and sectarian schools strongly believe this decision means vouchers will be declared constitutional in all cases and permit tax dollars to go to students who attend non-public sectarian schools. Do you think they're right in that analysis? They are very hopeful.
Well, I think they are right to this extent. If legislatures or local governments are careful to channel the public financing through the parents or through the children themselves, rather than directly transferring them to the religious school itself, the Supreme Court has already indicated that that kind of indirect funding of parochial education is constitutionally permissible. What has been forbidden up to now was a direct grant to a school, in other words, an immediate transfer of funds from a state or local treasury to a religious institution for religious purposes. So if legislatures are careful to draft programs that channel the aid through the medium of the parent's choice, then the Supreme Court has made clear, and probably would continue to do so, that that's a matter of private choice and not a matter of public funding of religious instruction as such. But we have to see more cases developed to see just exactly what the Supreme Court may ultimately have in mind when it directly confronts the question of the use of public funds. If it goes for direct instruction in religious matters of faith, then that may be problematic. But the court has at least invited experimentation in this area. And in this current political atmosphere, and given the energy of the campaign to finance parochial education with public resources, it's obvious that there are advocacy groups that will begin pressing as hard as they can to expand the Trinity Lutheran doctrine to the outer limits of constitutional logic.
We're talking with Lyle Denniston. He's a journalist who covered the Supreme Court for many years, and you're listening to the Religion and Constitution podcast. Let me get at this in a couple of other ways, Lyle, if I may. This seems to be a conflict between the concept of the Establishment Clause, which says Congress shall make no law respecting establishment of a religion, which has been perceived as no support of religion. In fact, the government should be completely neutral and secular in relation to religion. And the Free Exercise Clause, they're arguing that somehow or another, and I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around the logic, that denying a church public money for a playground somehow affects that church's ability to freely exercise their religion. I'm having a hard time understanding that. Can you sort that out for us a little bit?
Well, let me first say up front that your puzzlement is entirely common, because there has always been a tension, a constitutional tension, trying to rationalize the Establishment Clause with the Free Exercise Clause. The Supreme Court has spoken in using a phrase, there needs to be some play in the joints. And in other words, we cannot have a total disestablishment of religion in the sense that the government can have nothing whatever to do with religion. For example, churches are entitled to have the fire department come if they have a fire, or to have the police department come if they have a break-in or a burglary. Those general benefits are clearly available, the court has said, to religious institutions. And in order to avoid inhibiting their free exercise of religion, the Establishment Clause at the founding period and even today is predicated upon the premise that we need to keep the government out of involvement in religion in order to protect religion so that it has freedom to operate within the scope of the tenets of belief.
That was Thomas. That was Thomas Jefferson's specific analysis.
Yes, and it was also the view that James Madison, who is always often considered the father of the Constitution and clearly the father of the First Amendment, when he wrote the Virginia Declaration, when he was in the state assembly in the state of Virginia before the Constitution was written. So, but the idea is keep the government separated from religion in order to protect the government from religious divisiveness because of the difference in people's faith structures, and in order to protect faith from government involvement that would compromise the Free Exercise Clause. But in modern times, the Free Exercise Clause has been used by advocacy organizations much more aggressively to try to move religion into the public square. That's the phrase that is commonly used. And so all of our debates about whether or not there should be a prayer in public schools, whether or not religious institutions should be free from general public regulations, has expanded to the point where the Free Exercise Clause seems to be overtaking the concept of separation between church and government, at least in some ways. We see this now in the increased effort to try to get governments to approve of and display the Ten Commandments in public parks and on government property. We recently had a decision by a federal judge in Pensacola, Florida, ruling that a cross in a public park in Pensacola was unconstitutional under prevailing Supreme Court doctrine. But this judge went on to question whether or not prevailing Supreme Court doctrine should be changed. And we just recently got filed at the Supreme Court a case from New Mexico, a little city in New Mexico, that wants to have approval for a Ten Commandments monument on local government property. So there is a strong movement to advance the religious exercise as a basis for additional access to public benefits. And the Trinity Lutheran case falls exactly in that line of cases. We also have a number of other efforts to protect religious believers from having to obey government anti-discrimination laws. For example, the Supreme Court just last month agreed to rule at its next term on a case involving a Colorado bakery that is operated by a religious person who refused to bake a cake for a gay wedding. And that refusal was found to be a violation of a state law that protects sexual orientation from discrimination in public accommodations. So the wedding cake case, and now additional efforts to prevent the coercion of religiously devout private business owners from having to do business with gay and lesbian couples is providing a substantial amount of new litigation that is already working and has worked its way to the Supreme Court. So we are seeing a great deal more emphasis these days on accommodating religious belief systems than was, I think, hitherto the case in American history.
We have another podcast that deals with definitions of public accommodations and so forth. And that case is going to be very interesting to follow in the fall when it's argued. One of the things that strikes me, Lyle, is the people who are pushing so hard for public money to go into parochial sectarian schools through vouchers and so forth, and that is, be careful what you wish for, because there's a long history in the United States of Congress saying, if we give you the money, we can control and regulate how it's used. And that could lead to, theoretically, regulation of churches by Congress.
Well, and you know, even now, a religious parochial school has to abide by state educational standards in order to have their diplomas recognized. Just as the people who homeschool their children ultimately have to obey state regulations as to the content of education that they are purveying. So the minimum educational standards concept is a basis for government involvement in instruction in homeschools and in parochial schools. And the larger the financial involvement of the federal or state government in educational financing, the larger the regulatory oversight is going to be. And so we're back to Madison and Jefferson and the question of, if you're paying the piper, you call the tune, in the old phrase.
One of the things that that I want to deal with a little bit, Lyle, before we end our discussion today, is states' rights versus federal rights, state constitutions versus federal constitutions. The 14th Amendment has an equal protection clause, and that clause has been interpreted by the Supreme Court to mean that the federal constitution takes precedence over state and local laws in some important cases. Several First Amendment cases, for instance, and other kinds of cases have relied on the 14th Amendment. How does the 14th Amendment relate in this kind of case to support of religion by tax dollars?
Well, just look at Trinity Lutheran Church. The First Amendment and the religion clauses originally were put in the Constitution as a check upon the federal government's actions. But beginning in 1940, the Supreme Court started incorporating the religion clauses into the concept of liberty that protects against state intrusion with individual rights.
That would be Cantwell versus Connecticut.
Yes, and that was 1940, I believe.
Yes.
And the Supreme Court, by now, by the way, Jerry, almost all of the Bill of Rights have been incorporated into the 14th Amendment as a protection for the rights against the actions of state and local government. So the Trinity Lutheran case itself is a product of this whole historic process of incorporating the Bill of Rights, because Trinity Lutheran was invoking the free exercise component of the First Amendment as applied to the state of Missouri by the 14th Amendment. So the 14th Amendment has become the host of a much modern Supreme Court constitutional jurisprudence about civil rights, because almost all of the parts of the Bill of Rights have been made applicable to the states. Probably one of the most famous modern decisions along those lines was the ruling in 2008 in the gun rights case that made the Second Amendment apply to the 2010 decision made the Second Amendment apply to the states for the first time. So religion has, in fact, been protected from government intrusion or oversight or coercion since the 1940s.
As we speak in the summer of 2017, it strikes me, Lyle, that we are just beginning to see a whole series of questions that come before the courts in relation to free exercise in the United States. It's already coming, but it looks to me like there's going to be a deluge in the next few years. Is that a fair analysis?
Oh, I think that's true. We've already seen not more than just a trickle. We've seen already a flood of cases that are moving forward. And, you know, the new Trump administration is pushing this cause because the president early on issued an executive order in favor of religious liberty, and this requires federal agencies to examine all of their regulatory processes in order to ease the burden of government on the free exercise of religion. And probably the most vivid example of how that's going to play out is the government very soon will announce an abandonment of the Obamacare requirement that even religious institutions must provide free birth control for their female employees. There is a proposal now pending within the government to reverse course on that birth control mandate. And so a number of federal agencies are now under presidential command to look through their rules and regulations and to eliminate regulations that are said to interfere with the free exercise of religion. So we're seeing here a well-financed, a well-organized, nationwide intensive campaign to expand the concept of religious freedom and religious liberty. There are at least three, and now with the arrival of Justice Gorsuch, there are at least four members of the Supreme Court who are actively encouraging the development of this expanded concept of religious freedom. One clear example of that, Jerry, was a case that the court had not this immediate past term, but a year earlier, involving a law in the state of Washington that required pharmacists to fill prescriptions for birth controls, even if the use of such contraceptives was in contradiction of the faith of those pharmacists. And the Supreme Court refused to hear a challenge to that state law. And Justice Alito wrote a dissent, which was joined by both the Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas. And they said that if the denial of review of this claim is the future of this country, the future of religious liberty is in deep peril. And that's a view that I think Justice Gorsuch has previously expressed when he was on a lower federal court. So I think we now see a nucleus of four members of the Supreme Court, and sometimes that nucleus will be able to attract Justice Kennedy's vote, as they did in the Hobby Lobby case on the Affordable Care Act birth control mandate. And if Justice Kennedy retires and President Trump makes the replacement, you may well see the existence of a clear five-justice majority in favor of expanding constitutional protection for these broadened ideas of religious liberty.
Lyle Denniston, journalist, it is so good to talk to you today. I would be remiss, Lyle, if I didn't ask you to talk with the listeners a little bit about the National Constitution Center. I think a lot of people don't know that it exists. What is it? What does it do?
Well, the Constitution Center was endowed by Congress and created by Congress in order to create public literacy about what's in the Constitution and what it means. At one level, the Constitution Center, which is right in downtown, just within public view of Independence Hall, where, of course, the Constitution was written originally, and where the Liberty Bell is housed, in one dimension, it is a museum. It's a fabulous hands-on museum that celebrates the Constitution and its history. But even more importantly than its museum character is its public education character. And the center has a website called Constitution Daily, and that's where my material writing for them appears. It has the title Smart Conversation About the Constitution, and it's a forum for very wide-ranging discussion of constitutional history and contemporary constitutional issues, and it's a great forum for a series of podcasts on these overall questions about what was the Constitution, what is the Constitution, and the whole question of civic engagement with the Constitution is a primary mission of the center.
Lyle Denniston, thank you, sir, very much for talking with us today. I do appreciate your time. I know you've had some back problems, and it's a little bit painful for you, but I do appreciate it, and thank you, and good luck.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. There are a few things that I have done for these past six or more decades that fascinate me more than constitutional history, so I'd love to talk about it.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.
Religion and the Constitution is meant to offer a brief history of freedom of religion in the United States. It's intended to help you interpret what freedom of religion means in everyday life. These conversations with the legal experts and the narration will not answer every question about what the courts have said about religious freedom. They do attempt to give you a basic understanding of the law. Nothing here should be taken as legal advice. If you have a problem concerning religious freedom, you should contact qualified legal assistance. Thanks to Josh LaBella for helping with the research and street interviews. And thanks to Tedra Schneider for creating the theme music. And thank you for listening. I'm Jerry Dunkley.